think, holds the record for the most different research positions at PI, since she was a grad student in the very early days, also got her PhD from Potsdam, and then she was a PI postdoc, and then a Marie Curie Fellow at Utrecht, and a research group leader at the Max Planck Institute for Gravitational Physics in Potsdam, and then came here to PI as a faculty member. She has won various awards, including an ERA, and today she's going to tell us about quantum space-time engineering.
Thanks, Sven, for the nice introduction. So today I want to tell you a bit about my research, which is quantum space-time engineering. I changed into the engineering subjects, just to be on par with my twin brother, who usually complains that theoretical physics is useless. Okay, so to give you a context, quantum space-time basically has these two words, which were the main accomplishments in the last century. It is, yeah. And so as you well know, we have these two central accomplishments of the 20th century, quantum field theory, which describes basically three of our fundamental forces and all matter. And this quantum field theory is defined on a classical space-time, which is non-dynamical. In contrast, we have general relativity, which actually describes the dynamics of space-time, but it's also just involves classical space-time. And so this, as you know, general relativity, the geometry of space-time, describes the fourth force, which is gravity, and its interaction with classical matter. And these theories work very well in most regimes we are interested in. However, they break down in extreme regimes with very high curvature and high energies. And these extremes are, however, very interesting, at least for a small subgroup of people, because we hope if we can resolve these situations like a Big Bang and black holes, we would even learn more about what really space-time is and what time is in particular. And so the hope is that basically unifying these two theories, or to have a big theory called quantum gravity, from which you could derive in a certain limit quantum field theory and general relativity, would basically allow us to describe these interesting situations like Big Bang and black holes, and resolve these paradoxes which we otherwise have in just having these two separate theories. And so quantum gravity actually means, it just means the quantization of gravity, but gravity is really encoded in the geometry of space-time. So what we really need to understand to have a theory of quantum gravity is to have an understanding of quantum space-time. And so the central research aim is basically to understand what is quantum space-time, and connected to that, what is the nature of time, and so on, and what is the nature of space. And so the talk overview, which is outlined here, and the first thing we will review basically the question, how can we do any quantum field theory, or whatever field means in this context, without having space-time? Because it's this space-time, or this quantum space-time, which has to emerge from the theory. So you can't really start with the space-time if you want to have this emergent. The next point is to how to construct quantum geometry. And this, we have several models now for quantum geometry. And the last point, which probably will not be much time for it, will be how to construct quantum space-time. And here the difference is that quantum space-time really describes the actual dynamics of quantum geometry. Okay, so let us review what we usually do if we do quantum field theory. So mostly, actually, we do perturbative quantum field theory and compute here these nice Feynman diagrams which somebody put there on the blackboard. And so what does it mean? You see that basically having some underlying space-time is essential here. In particular, it's, for instance, essential to define basically asymptotic regions which are far apart. because just to define far, you need a notion of what is actually the distance to Bloom's region. And usually we use these asymptotic regions to say that at these regions we have a free theory, because for instance the particles are separated very farly apart. And so what we also do is to use the Hilbert space for the free theory. So actually we typically don't have a Hilbert space for really the interacting theory, which means that we don't have a Hilbert space supporting the actual vacuum of our theory, but we have the Fock space. And we just describe basically the matrix elements of processes happening like scattering amplitudes and so on. And again, these are just basically defined with respect to the states of the free theory. Also, we have these field observables, which are basically the basic ingredients of quantum field theories and the most important thing of the theory. But these are, again, observables of the free theory. And as we will see, it's basically even these observables, which we don't have in quantum gravity, which makes life much more difficult here. So that is basically the setup for perturbative quantum field theory, where again you have a fixed notion of time and space. And you can try to do perturbative quantum gravity, and it has its use in some regimes. However, ultimately, as a complete theory, it fails because it turns out to be non-renormalizable. More importantly, if you really want to understand what is quantum spacetime or what happens at the Big Bang, then the situation you are forced to here, having three regions or two regions where you have three series, does not apply. So it doesn't really answer your crucial questions about the nature of spacetime. So in contrast, in quantum gravity, we basically have therefore to deal with a fully interacting theory. And time and space, in some sense, are really part of the variables of your theory, so they actually fluctuate in some sense. So what you would need is really a Hilbert space supporting really the expectations of your full theory, and that's an open question how to construct this. Additionally, there's this difficulty that the things which we are used to are as observables and needed from field theory, something like the field operator at the space-time point, is not an operator of general relativity, because it's not diffeomorphic and invariant. So basically here the question is, what kind of observables do you actually have to represent? And this brings us to the question of basically what is diffeomorphic and invariant. It's basically that space-time coordinates, these are just something we choose to describe a situation, but we are free to choose any set of space-time coordinates. There's no preferred check. So they don't have any physical significance. And that means that we need to implement diffeomorphism invariants, the diffeomorphism of the gauge symmetry, to avoid assigning unphysical quantum fluctuations to the choice of coordinates. And so the central aim is basically quantum gravity research is to construct a Hilbert space supporting diffeomorphism invariant excitations and operators to actually extract quantum geometry. And so there are basically, you know, many different approaches to quantum gravity based on different kinds of inputs. And I'm concentrating on basically stuff which is inspired by loop quantum gravity, because it's the approach where one actually most explicitly constructs such a Hilbert space and the quantum geometry. Okay, so let me. In this list? Yeah, in some sense. But, we can discuss. There are lots of approaches missing, because there are more approaches in quantum gravity researchers, of course. Okay. Okay, so let me basically give you an idea on the progress which has been achieved in constructing such quantum geometry realizations. And basically, it's really that in the 90s, we had the first rigorous construction of, or in fact, the first example of a spatially, of a Hilbert space supporting spatially diffeomorphism invariant excitations. So spatially here is quite important, so it means it's invariant under only the subgroup of coordinate changes in your space at a fixed time, not under time reparametrization. and so this Hilbert space, however, supports the observer algebra of general relativity in matter, and kinematically means that they are not really fully diffeomorphism invariant. so I will explain soon this Hilbert space in more detail. So it's actually the difficulty of this construction is actually based on a vacuum which describes no spatial geometry. So basically the spatial geometry is totally degenerate. It's like having a matrix which only has zero entries. And that makes dealing with the Hilbert space or building interesting states which describe your extended geometries quite difficult, because you would have to build them up with lots of excitations. And soon I will also tell you what this uniqueness theorem means. So basically that this construction has to be thought to be unique. And it is under a list of assumptions. And one of those assumptions is the spatial diffeomorphism invariant. And actually Tim Kozlowski, which has been a postdoc here, pointed out that if you forget about the spatial diffeomorphism invariant, you can actually via a nice mathematical technique describe also space times or a vacuum where you have a condensed background spatial geometry. And this, of course, is not any more diffeomorphism covariant, but it gives you an idea that you can actually change this very funny no spatial geometry vacuum. So now the question was, is this really the only diffeomorphism invariant construction? And recently we could show that there's basically a Hilbert space with the quantum geometry realization, which is very different from this Arthur Lewandowski one, from the first one, and where the vacuum rather describes no curvature. Furthermore, we basically argued that actually, if you have a topological field theory or a topological phase, which is kind of related to the variables we have here, any such phase gives rise to a spatial diffeomorphism invariant Hilbert space. So from basically zero realizations, we went to one realization in the 90s, and now we have two, but we have a general technique to construct more realizations depending on how many topological phases we might find. Moreover, there's also a strategy to obtain basically space-time diffeomorphism invariant theory, so dealing with the time reparametrizations. That involves solving the dynamics of the theory, so it's important to have an approximation scheme. Okay, so as I mentioned, there's this uniqueness theorem developed by a bunch of people, and basically the psychology then was, okay, there's only this one Hilbert space representation which even supports just the spatial diffeomorphism invariant excitation, because there's only one, we have to stick with it, because it's only, we have proven there are only one, so it has to be the correct one, even if the Hilbert space representation is really tame and doing interesting physics. so basically what we did is, in constructing this representation, is to avoid one of the assumptions of the theorem, which I will remark later on. And with this strategy, there could be basically several Hilbert spaces, and you can always choose the most convenient one, depending on what you want to do. Okay, so that gives you basically a bit the overview of where we stand. And I started with explaining, you know, what is perturbative quantum gravity. We also know how to do, in principle, non-perturbative quantum field theory. In particular, it's very successful in the context of lattice state theory. And that is by putting stuff on a lattice, which allows you to basically regularize things. And so, indeed, we will see that what we do is to use certain lattice techniques. However, we have to be careful because lattice is an additional background structure, and surely it breaks basically diffeomorphism invariant. So basically the key is to use the same variables as on the lattice, which I will explain in a second, but actually to not restrict the theory to the actual letters. And the challenge there is to specify the phimorphism in my vacuum state, which actually is specified everywhere, not just on the lattice. And here we have these variables in lattice state theory, which we will see again. This is the Wilson loop, which measures the curvature of your gauge connection. And actually, there's also electrical field operator, which is measures the electric flux, which goes through a surface. And here it basically cuts the Wilson loop so it's really orthogonal to this actually edge, so it measures the electrical field along this edge. Okay, so let me explain you how to build this quantum geometry and what I understand. And the quantum geometry is here a representation of operators encoding geometry on a Hilbert space. So the first thing you need is basically, you know, having variables which encode the geometry. And key progress was made by Ashika, inventing the Ashika variables. And what happens there is actually that the geometric variables which we have to describe the geometry of space-time, which are metric and curvature, these can be actually encoded into variables we use for electromagnetism or more generally for Young-Mills theory. And these then happen to be the same variables we use for lattice and Mills theory. There's magnetic field observables. And these are the loop operators associated to a curve. Before the curve was on a lattice, now it's just an arbitrary curve. And this Wilson loop operator in Young-Mills theory, it measures the magnetic field. And it generates, so here generates doesn't mean really a physical process. It means that if you apply it to a state, then the state afterwards has basically one electrical flux line more, which is exactly the line of this Wilson loop. So in this sense, it generates an electrical flux line. So these are the, I will denote these operators by H, which stands for holonomy, and also in monobian theories, there's usually a little index which basically tells you the strength of the electrical field that generates. So J is the number of flux lines, roughly. So this is the interpretation in Young-Mills theory. In this gravity context, it measures the curvature, and it's actually the extrinsic curvature. So and it will generate quanta of spatial geometry. And so these variables are actually conjugated to electrical field observables, so which measures the electrical field flux to a surface, so it's a proof of surface. And because it's conjugated, it generates the magnetic field, which is measured by this Wilson loop. And in the gravity context, it measures this spatial geometry, so it measures spatial areas, angles, and volumes, and so on, and it generates curvature. So the interesting fact is that these variables have commutation relations, so they are actually conjugated to each other in some sense. And the only important thing about this commutation relation is that as opposed to just if you think about the scalar field and the conjugated momentum, these relations do not involve any type of background matrix. So basically the point is here that they are only non-vanishing if really this flux line goes through the surface. If they are separated, they are vanishing. And the only thing is that the topology matters whether this curve cuts the surface or not. And so how do we build our quantum geometric state? So the one thing, if you really think about how do we construct Hilbert spaces, we usually have to choose a vacuum, and we generate the rest of the Hilbert space by applying operators to this vacuum. So what we have to specify is the vacuum state, and this is constructed in such a way that basically all flux operators on this vacuum state have vanishing expectation values and vanishing fluctuations. So the fluxes are encoding the spatial geometry. That means that the vacuum actually is peaked on vanishing spatial geometry. And usually we denote this vacuum by zero for some reason. And so here you have this vacuum, it's actually nothing. And so then the question is, how do we get, so this is one state, so we need a excited state. And this we usually do by applying operators to that. And so usually you can basically generate the entire Hilbert space from the vacuum state by applying these operators, and here these holonomy operators actually do generate the entire Hilbert space. And these holonomy operators, I mentioned that they generate fluxus lines. So here are the flux lines, and they come with the Grundy phase and so on. And that's what is known as a synergy of FT. And so these flux lines give some flux operators actually non-vanishing excitation value. And so what we have is really a realization of quantum geometry. So this picture really encodes quantum geometry. And it was developed over some years, of course, with many people to get to the final picture. And so in principle, you can take a state and extract the geometry out of the state. And so there are some particularities. So basically, if you have a flux line, then you can consider the electric field orthogonal to the flux line, so associated to a surface cutting the flux line. And the expectation value of these operators will tell you stuff about the areas and angles of your spatial geometry, and you can similarly construct the volume of your states associated to these nodes. However, if you have no flux line, it means that there's nothing and there's zero volume associated to the region, because it's basically here where you have vacuum state. So in some sense, the flux lines are really defects away from the totally degenerate geometry. Just defects understood usually in the opposite way. And in this way, we have a quantum state which determines quantum geometry. And moreover, you can basically formulate it in a spatial diffeomorphism invariant way. So that's one version to encode your quantum geometry. And in fact, the problem is in these regions of zero volume. That means if you want to have an expanded geometry, you have to construct a very complicated dense in some abstract sense, basically a spin network with lots of edges and lots of nodes. So in contrast, you can actually go with kind of an opposite vacuum state. So here the first step is basically specifying this vacuum state, which is now such that all curvature operators have vanishing expectations and fluctuations. And so it's again denoted by this funny symbol, the zero, and here you have this vacuum state. So now you need also excited states, and so here we have a vanishing curvature. And so that means actually to get kind of defects from vanishing curvature, we need to apply flux operators, which generate curvature. And actually, we need to apply this generation usually happens via exponentiated operators. So we need to apply the exponentiated flux operators. And if you remember, this is a little detail which is different or which violates the uniqueness theorem, because it turns out that only these exponentiated flux operators do exist as operators in the Hilbert space. Okay, so what you get by applying these operators, you apply lots of them. They are actually based on surfaces. The surfaces, they cut in edges. And the state describes curvature defects, which are actually based on these edges in 3+1 dimension. Alphas, yeah, you can imagine them as certain angles, because it is the angles of the curvature defect, the deficit angle. Thank you. So now if you want to build basically a state with no curvature, but with extended geometry, you could do that by just taking the vacuum. If you want to have a state with curvature, you would have to apply all these flux operators and get something which you can take to be a triangulation. And so as before, you have actually now, if you have no edge, that's just the That's the region where basically you have no curvature, and it's exactly peaked on non-vanishing on vanishing curvature. That means the conjugated variable, which is spatial geometry, is completely uncertain. So it actually doesn't mean that you have well-defined spatial geometry, or it's completely uncertain. And if you have a line, and usually there's some index to it, you usually have a curvature defect if alpha is not zero. Actually, if you are in condensed matter, that is actually exactly the state of a BF topological theory with defects, which are these excitations. And so in C plus one, these defects are in fact based on lines. If you're in 2+1, then it actually gives, these states actually give solutions to 2+1 gravity, so they're actually really quantum space-time, and the defects are actually quantum particles. So here you have a quantum state which determines a very different quantum geometry from the one we had before. And in fact, they are based on vacua, which are oppositely free states, because the one curvature is completely uncertain and the other is completely peak. And so that means that the entire Hilbert space, or the space supported by these representations, has completely different interpretations. Okay, so these quantum geometry realizations are basically what we call kinematical. So I haven't spoken about dynamics before. So the question is, what happens with quantum geometry dynamics? And here we come to interpretational issues, which are a bit confusing. So we have defined these quantum geometries actually in 3D space at a fixed time. However, they're really quantum states, and they really encode the 4D quantum history, or the 4D quantum geometry. However, almost all of these states describe basically quantum geometries, which are, in some sense, virtual, in the same sense that you have virtual particles. So they're actually non-dynamical and don't satisfy the quantum equation of motions. So what we need, actually, or what a theory of quantum gravity tells, needs to deliver is the physical state which really solves the quantum equations of motion of the theory. And so we could ask, you know, why do we care about different kinematical vacua apart from having nice realizations, the first realizations of spatially diffeomorphic and invariant excitations? In fact, different vacua are very useful in standard quantum field theory, and they are needed to describe interesting processes like symmetry breaking and condensation processes. And here it's very analogous to this equation. So in practice, as I told you, we need basically physical states, and these physical states need to satisfy the quantum equation of motion. So that's very similar to asking for the energy eigenstates in a non-perturbative quantum field theory. And if you ask for these states, these will be usually outside your pre-Hilbert state. They're basically not even normalizable or not elements of the pre-Hilbert state. So actually, that means that we expect that the physical states will be actually outside these Hilbert spaces. Nevertheless, we use these representations to try to construct physical states. And in this context, it's very important to have different starting points. And so you can compare that to, if you want to build a statue, you can start with a block of stone and chisel away until you get your statue out of this block of stone. Or you can start from nothing and basically glue little stuff until you get the statue. And in this context, so this is the question, what is the better vacuum? And the one reason why this BF theory vacuum is better is actually that it's really used for the construction of spin foams, which are supposed to encode the dynamics of loop quantum gravity. So really, interesting vacuum, or what vacuum should be adjusted to the dynamics of the system. And so that means that we, you know, as conditions change or you have things change, you have also to change your vacuum. And so what does the dynamics of the system mean? That is usually imposed here in the quantum theory by applying a path integral. So for a state time evolution, I will usually mean applying path integrals just in the context, because evolution is again something which is a bit subtle to interpret in quantum gravity. And so usually the vacuum state is even defined as a state which is invariant under time evolution. In diffeomorphism invariant systems, it happens that all physical states, so basically all states of the theory, should be invariant under time evolution. And that actually means that the path integral is a projector on the physical state. And so to construct physical states, we actually need to construct the path integral for gravity. So the path integral is usually the sum over all histories which can happen. So in the context of space-time histories, it's the sum over space-time geometry. We don't only need the path integral kind of in its configuration form. We need actually to apply the path integral to a state, because we want to know what are states which are basically invariant under the path integral operator. So in this context, what you have to do is just to take the inner product of your path integral operator with boundary states, which in principle live at the boundary of these quantum space times, but again actually encode for the quantum geometry. So what we need to construct is basically these path integral matrix elements, and that means, you know, usually what there are two ingredients to that. One is the quantum amplitude, which is the exponential of the action. And the other thing, which is notoriously very hard to define, is actually what do you mean with a sum? And what do you sum over? Okay, so let me just give you a simple reason why this path integral is a projector. So basically, this path integral, so this cylinder represents the sum over all space-time geometries. In particular, what you can have is this arbitrary large or small time extension. So now you apply twice the path integral, which actually means that you put here, you glue these two boundary states together and sum over all boundary states. And so you have two cylinders with arbitrary time extension that you integrate over. So if you glue these two things, you get actually, again, one cylinder with arbitrary time extension, which you sum over. So that means that T squared is P, which is exactly the projector property. And so we have, you know, so let's try to construct a path integral, which means making sense out of business of sum or integral over all kinds of space-time geometry. And there, in this arrow, there are basically many choices you can make. And if you are basically a syndrome person, you do the following. You discretize basically your auxiliary space-time in the sense that you choose a triangulation for it. And then you use the quantum geometry realizations which have been built previously to construct the notion of labels which encode too many geometries. So these labels are the same we had for the Wilson loop operators. So they really encode the geometry of the triangulation. And then you need to also construct the amplitudes from the general relativity action at the minimum factor points. And because of that, there are a bunch of models. And this gives you basically a discrete model for your path integral, in the sense that you have chosen a discretization to begin with, and so far you integrate only over finitely many degrees of freedom. The problem is this discretization, again, in general, will break the diffeomorphism symmetry, which is the one which ensures this projector property. So the projector property can only be expected actually to hold in the refinement limit. And so the challenge is really to compute this class integral in this definement limit, which means that you actually have to sum here really about over infinity many variables. Okay, so that will be basically the challenge in constructing physical states. And so the question is, do we already know states that satisfy this equation? And in 3D, yes, because it's actually the BF vacuum state. As I told you, the BF vacuum satisfies 2 plus 1 gravity. And in 4D, the answer is no, at least not for these really gravitational spin form models. And the construction of these states is actually the key problem which we are going to discuss now. So I told you, if you have the path integral, you can actually construct really physical states. And here is a particular physical state you can construct. And this one is basically taken from taking the cylinder and closing one boundary. So actually, it's a kind of a version of the Hartle-Hawking no boundary wave function. So it's kind of a simplified version of that. And actually, how you can, in this context, close this boundary is to actually define on this boundary the state, which is a kinematic event. So pictorially, you get basically here this phi, which itself is a path integral. And for the same reason as before, this state will be really invariant under this applying the path integral operator. So this means that if we manage to really construct the state, this will be really a physical state. And actually, in this interpretation, it is really the vacuum functional. So it's actually the dual vacuum in some sense, but we will call it the vacuum functional for boundary wave functions which are defined on this boundary. So in this funny dimension, 1 plus 1, what we have to do is basically compute a path integral over this disk, and you get a wave function on the boundary of the system. And actually, these vacuum amplitudes are basically the same which define which we use in the path integral. So they actually encode dynamics, and if you take the refinement limits, they really encode continuum dynamics. So now we just need to face this small challenge to compute the path integral in the refinement limit. I guess if it would be easy, it would have been done. For a range of reasons, it's quite difficult to do for 4D gravitational spin forms. It's a non-perturbative problem. And if you remember, I mentioned lattice QCD, which is used very successfully for QCD. But it mostly uses Monte Carlo simulations to basically actually get around this problem of summing over infinitely many variables. And unfortunately, we cannot really use Monte Carlo simulations because we actually deal really with quantum amplitudes. That means we have a complex amplitude, apart from complicated amplitudes. So there are additional difficulties because the sensitive summations over infinite ranges, and we would also expect that certain divergences actually do to diffeomorphic symmetry. And there's a practical problem that so far there's not really a real space cost-running method available for the 4D spin-form model, but we are trying to design such models. So what we so far did in basically asking this question, what could you in principle get out of these spin-form path integrals, is to design simpler analog models and two dimensions, because two dimensions is always much simpler than four dimensions. And we designed these analog models in the hope that they capture key dynamical ingredients of spin forms. So this hope has actually some motivation because it's a similar relation between these analog models and the spin form models as the relation between 2D and 4D of lattice state theories to spin systems, where there are actually lots of similarities in the phase structure and so on. And in this case, we could actually use existing methods, which are known as tensor network renormalization, to compute the refinement limit, starting with a range of models. So that's what we did, and especially a problem for many body physics. So these analog models turned out to be very similar to so-called anionic spin case. But despite being defined in 2D, they can actually also be interpreted as particular spin forms, which just have two space-time atoms in some sense, and which are connected with lots of edges. And so the refinement limit is in the number of these edges. So we consider the range of models, and this range are described by some parameters which you can understand in describing you how you glue these two space-time atoms together. And it turns out that actually these models have a very rich phase structure. So there are lots of different phases you can find, which in principle could be also specified. And these different phases in this interpretation of the two space-time atom spin form describe either completely uncoupled space-time atoms. So basically you take the limit where you have infinitely edges, but nevertheless in this limit these two things completely decouple. And there are coupled space-time atoms, which here are basically these orange points and these blue points. There are orange is a more interesting thing because the blue stuff is just the analog thing to EF series. So this rich phase-based structure gives us actually positive hope for finding interesting cases in spin forms because of these dualities which also hold for lattice gauge series. And so the question now is to confirm that for spin forms. For which, first we need really to develop algorithms to the defend force going really before the dimensional spin forms. Technically, again, there's a tight relation to lattice gauge series. Spin forms, in a sense, are generalized lattice gauge series. That means the theory space for spin forms is much larger than in lattice gauge series. And so the question we want to answer is, the hope you can have is a larger theory space is that there are also much more phases in the theory space, the fixed points if you want. And so we know in lattice gauge series there are basically two phases, which are the confining phase and the deconfining phase. And actually these two phases are exactly the two vacua we have realized so far, because the confining phase corresponds to the small space phase. Which they had, so that there's this Aschbacher-Lewandowski-Eichen vacuum. And the deconfining phase is actually exactly the BF topological phase, which was our vacuum constructed and gives 3D gravity. And so the key question then is, are there more phases in spin forms? And in fact, we have these positive indications from 2D analog models. And the interesting point is every new phase gives rise to a new vacuum and new quantum geometry realization. And if you have the phase, it usually imports a non-trivial topological lattice field theory, because everything is usually fine still on a lattice. And this topological lattice field series comes with some amplitudes, and these amplitudes actually you can take to define the vacuum functional, which will underlie your Hilbert space differentiation. That's the easier part, actually. The more complicated part is really to figure out what is the structure of defects of this topological theory, because the defects will define the excitations of the theory. And what you hope is that these excitations really support basically the observable algebra of your theory. and basically then there's this trick to get rid of this lattice here and this lattice field theory. There's a technique for the inductive limit construction, which is a technical thing which allows arbitrary lattices and allows you to basically describe these defects inside the continuum Hilbert space for excitation. So this gives you basically all kinds of topological field theories plus defects. And basically, you need to use these defects to really express the dynamics of quantum gravity, because we know in 4D, quantum gravity is not really a topological field theory. So in this one slide, let me explain you how to express the continuum dynamic. So far, if you basically put up your discrete path integral that was usually defined by defining amplitudes associated to your simplest building block. And then it was thought that defines your theory, because in principle you just need to compute, you know, a path integral for arbitrary many building blocks by gluing all these building blocks together and summing. So this is a form of a theory which is slightly unpractical, because you don't know what you get after summing over all these building blocks. And so the question is, how can you get basically a form of the theory which is more practical? And that actually means that you already need to encode your continuum dynamics in a form which you can immediately use. And in this formulation, what you have to get rid of is this idea of fundamental building blocks. You actually interpret these fundamental building blocks as the boundaries, so you actually see really, if you aren't 3D, the important stuff is just the triangulation of the boundary, which in this case is a triangulation of the sphere. And here you have a simple boundary, so it supports only certain excitations, namely along the edges of the triangulation. And you can think that you have a boundary Hilbert space associated to this triangulation, supporting excitations along the four edges. what you need to construct is basically an embedding of the Hilbert space based on this kind of simple network into a Hilbert space based on this more complicated network. And so you can actually go on and have construct embeddings for more and more complicated networks until you go really to the refinement limit. So it's actually this sequence of discrete Hilbert spaces which will really define you the continuum Hilbert space. But the advantage of having the sequence is that at every level, if you really want to do a computation, you can always restrict to a given discretization or a given kind of complexity class of waveform. So now assume that you do a computation with, say, this complexity class of wave functions, so this is, say, naively discretization. What you now need to ensure is that doing this calculation, the results don't change if you go to this much finer triangulation and repeat the calculation, ask the same question. And so if you know what the Wilsonian renormalization condition is, that's exactly basically the condition that if you include more degrees of freedom, your answer doesn't change. So what you define in this way is actually family of effective models, or a family of effective actions. And here it's basically effective quantum amplitudes. And so you need this family of effective quantum amplitudes. And this condition that basically the computation here gets you the same answer as the computation here is actually that in an appropriate sense, you get these medium complicated amplitudes from the more complex amplitudes by restricting to wave functions which just live on this medium triangulation. So it's basically just this condition that observables, if you compute them on different discretizations, they stay the same. And that means that you have, if you compute an observable here, that you will get the same result for this observable here as in the continuum limit. So now the problem, so that's actually a complete family of these consistent amplitudes. The consistent means that this restriction holds, would define you a complete theory of quantum gravity. And this theory is to be understood in the sense that it corresponds to a complete renormalization trajectory. And renormalization trajectory usually means that you have a parameter which is the scale of the theory, And here the scale is kind of given by complexity parameters. The complexity you can understand obviously how complicated your network here is. So the basic question now is how do you compute these amplitudes? Because basically these amplitudes which give you the solution of the theory. And in fact, you can compute them iteratively in a certain approximation scheme, which is actually based on tensor network and normalization. And the least effort is necessary for basically this low complexity, which then in this physical interpretation, you hope really can be interpreted as homogeneous configurations. And so this would be actually having the interpretation that these homogeneous configurations describe you, for instance, quantum cosmology. So in this sense, it would be really quantum cosmology from the theory. And as I told you, there is really a scheme that you can compute them starting from these initial kind of discrete amplitudes. And in fact, the initial discrete amplitude gives you an approximation to the first lowest complexity amplitude. However, it's just an approximation because in itself it will not satisfy basically this kind of restriction property. And so this is what one needs to compute, and for basically topological, for these topological field theories, these embeddings are both given by the topological field theories, and the amplitudes then are very easily basically consistent in this way. So the problem is to define it for non-topological theories, and that brings me actually to a summary. So basically, we try to do non-perturbative quantum gravity and actually treat it very similar to condensed matter, however, in a very different philosophy from condensed matter as many body systems. And so to having these many body systems, this is the main problem, is to figure out what happens if you really incorporate infinitely many degrees of freedom. And the first step is really to figure out what are the phases and phase conditions for these quantum gravity models, for which we can use numerical methods, but also basically methods from kind of the same methods which allow you to categorize and classify all cases, which are category methods. I explained to you actually having these cases, these are topological field theories. We can always understand the topological fields or topological field theories have defects, and these defects you can hope they support basically these quantum geometry realizations. So having a phase, you having a new phase, especially there's a new quantum geometry realization, and the question is which quantum geometry realization is the nearest to the real physical states. And so to go from this box to this box, this is just rather mathematical physics and using this technique of inductive limit response. And here an interesting question is phase transitions can be actually formulated similarly, and that is an open question. Because that would also mean that you can formulate phase transitions in a diffeomorphism invariant way. It would be very interesting. Apart from this identifying phases and transitions, you can use these numerical methods to really try to see what is this consistent family of amplitudes. And basically that is done in an approximation scheme, but the question is if this family exists, that will really give you a definition of quantum space-time. And if you have that, you just go somewhere else. And so thank you for your attention.
So, questions?
So, I have a very naive question, plus a couple of technical questions. So the naive one is, in your new vacuum, kinematic vacuum state, you say that the curvature is zero. but the spatial geometry is completely uncertain. So naively, that's a contradiction, because if the spatial, if the curvature is zero, you would think that up to diffeomorphism anyway, the geometry is flat.
Sometimes I have extrinsic curvature.
Extrinsic curvature.
Yeah, so it's more correctly the curvature of this Ashtika connection, which is extrinsic.
Which involves the 4D.
Which is the extrinsic curvature plus the spin connection, but if as you say, the kind of spatial curvature or the spatial geometry is completely fixed, then the spin connection is completely fixed.
Oh, I see. So the information is on the extrinsic curvature, not on the
intrinsic. You are right. If it would be just spatial curvature, these would not be conjugated to each other. So it's really variables which are conjugated to each other.
Right. Another technical question is, near the end you described this way of passing to a continuum limit via sequence of embeddings. And you kind of stressed that the embeddings are important, so not just the sequence of more and more refined triangulations. So the question is, could the answer depend on how you choose the embedding? I mean, given two triangulations, there's in general no unique way of embedding one in another.
Yeah, so certainly, and in fact, it's a very good question. In fact, these two vacua give you two very different embeddings you have to apply. Because, for instance, for the second vacuum, if you embed basically these wave functions into this set of wave functions, then you have more edges here. And the question is, what do you assign to these more edges?
Right.
And the answer is to every additional edge, you basically assign a vanishing deficit angle, so these alphas. And so this would define you an embedding where you could really understand the wave function which is left here as a wave function which lives here, but actually most parameters here would be zero. So that is one way of embedding your structure. And so actually, in this case, you use really the vacuum state also as an embedding your Hilbert space. And the Ashtika-Lewandowski vacuum, again, is completely different. Because what you said zero there is these labels, the spin labels, they which give you the spatial geometry excitation. And so the embeddings are basically, again, have an opposite interpretation in these two cases. And so the question, in fact, in the scheme is which choice of embedding actually simplifies your life in computing this sequence of amplitudes. And so the answer is again that these embeddings should be carefully constructed, which is actually part of this iterative scheme, so that in fact the embedding, in fact, if you go from a less complicated state to a more complicated state, how do you do that? You usually add only degrees of freedom in a vacuum state. So for that you need to know what is actually the vacuum state. So in this way you should also just embedding to the dynamics of the system.
Bianca, so if I understood properly, you have a research program towards solving quantum gravity, but it appears that in the process you will also have solved non-perturbative quantum field theory. Is that correct?
In the sense that... in an approximation. So
sorry?
There's an approximation scheme.
Right, but it seems that you would have, as a byproduct, also a way of attacking field theories non-perturbatively, where there are no issues about space-time. That's a well-defined concept. So is that a standalone byproduct of
is that a time?
Would that be a standalone? I mean, is that something that...
I'm also interested in these aspects. So basically, it's similar to this is a question how to formulate quantum field theories with tensor network methods.
Right. Okay. Thanks.
Are these different vacua physically distinct in that, like, could you do an experiment to determine whether we live in vacuum one or vacuum two of this theory? Like, I don't know, one makes some different prediction about the way the universe grows or something.
Yeah, so these different vacua, they are so-called kinematical vacua. So they're not really so to explain first, the notion of vacuum and quantum gravity is generally unknown because we don't really have the concept of a Hamiltonian or energy in general relativity. Because basically what we have is a quantum equation of motion which tells us that energy vanishes for all states, for all physical states. So you need to come up with some notion of vacuum, and in this here, it would be basically the vacuum which really is associated to the simplest state. So it's kind of the lowest complexity state, which you can hope then really corresponds to at least some homogeneous configuration. So here now we can ask, what you get in this procedure, would you get a unique vacuum, which would be kind of the unique physical vacuum if you apply this. And in fact, an interesting question is, if you start with these two different kinematical vacua, do you get two different physical vacua? And that I can't answer yet. It's a very interesting question, but it's, you would maybe assume yet, yes or not, depending on the phase structure of your theory. And it could be basically indeed that even the notion of vacuum in quantum gravity is not unique, because it means homogeneous states, but homogeneous is especially homogeneous in which variable? And in quantum theory, you can choose conjugated variables, and homogeneous in one or the other variables have very different properties. So the answer is, the question is vacuum, is maybe the notion of vacuum even unique in quantum gravity? So it's maybe a question about initial conditions, related to the question of initial conditions, and probably this Hartle-Hawking no-boundary wave function.
So are the, if they are really distinct physical vacua, these two kinematical mm-hmm. vacua, is this the beginning of the quantum gravity landscape?
No.
I mean, if you say it's now a question of initial conditions, then it's the beginning of the landscape.
I mean, a landscape of two vacua so far. So basically, the question would be to construct states which really represent our universe. And in this question, the question of non-uniqueness of vacuum would be also the question: what does it mean to have a unique? Can you predict really? A unique vacuum, or can you predict a number of vacua? But the landscape would be really start if you really could actually do this program and be sure that starting from each kinematic vacuum, you really get a consistent family. And that's a very non-trivial question. Basically, kind of a similar question which the asymptotic safety approach tries to answer.
Next, okay.
Yeah, so I have a question on your vacuum state. Most people make an assumption that personally I don't agree with, because I believe, as you know, in the Lorentzian, the path integral is fundamentally not Lorentzian and not Euclidean. But most people, especially when talking about something like Hartle-Hawking state, it's usually an assumption that the path integral is performed over a Euclidean signature. Mm-hmm. Now, and we know that has problems, or may mm-hmm. very likely has problems. Can you make some comments on that? In your discussion, it looked like you were using a Lorentzian path integral. So when you say Hartle-Hawking state, do you mean the analog of that for a Lorentzian path integral, or do you literally mean to do a Wick rotation and do a Euclidean signature version?
So let me back up and tell you that to in general to explain the basically path integrals which are fully quantum mechanically and for Lorentzian spacetime. And if you big rotate that, you get basically the so-called Euclidean path integral, which actually is this exponential minus s, so it's just a real, this kind of a real amplitude. And that's what we don't do in spin forms. In spin forms, we have the quantum amplitude. And in principle, we can both describe Lorentzian and Euclidean signature matrix. And the point is that technically, it's much simpler for us to deal with Euclidean space-time matrix, because these correspond to compact gate groups. And it's a bit harder to deal with non-compact gate groups. So, so far, what we actually do so far is we're really constructing these Euclidean signature theories, but for really the quantum case, so with complex amplitude. And so there's really an interesting question, which is to, so in this sense, I meant Hartle Hawking in the simplified version of ignoring this question of space-time signature. And in general, I would say for me, it's an interesting question how to really define that in a Lorentzian spacetime with Euclidean signature. So there are some interesting developments which might allow to incorporate a signature change, really. If you really want to understand what happens if you want to go to a Big Bang, then, for instance, in new quantum cosmologies, there are scenarios which really describe a matrix which needs to basically change to Euclidean signature to basically describe the fact that there's no space that for propagating degrees of freedom, and so if you actually change the signature, then effectively your particles don't propagate anymore. And so how, that's how it works, and that would be an interesting mechanism to implement, but I haven't really implemented it yet.
Are there any more questions? Okay, then let's thank Bianca again.